So welcome again, everybody. And this is our first Sunday of the practice period. We had our retreat last weekend, opening our practice period. And for those people who are new, who may not know what a practice period is, it's just the time when we intensify our practice, a little more sitting, a little more study, and people make individual commitments as well. And there's lots of information about the practice period on the website. We extend our hours a little bit. So we start at 9:30 and go to 12:30, rather than our usual starting time at 10 to noon. And that's just to give us a little more sitting and also make sure we have time for a talk and a little bit of time spent with each other as well. And there's still, please don't worry about it, there's still cookies and tea at the end. Last Wednesday, I gave the first talk in this series of introducing sometimes what's known as proto-Chan, or we could say proto-Zen, the kind of what was going on before Zen became Zen in China. And I introduced a text called the Two Entrances, Four Practices that we talked about on Wednesday, supposedly composed by this guy called Bodhidharma. So I'm going to talk about Bodhidharma today in a little more depth. Not so much about something that he wrote, but rather the Bodhidharma of the legend. So as Kate mentioned in her talk on last Sunday during the practice period, much of what we know and has been said about Bodhidharma, both in China and Japan, is the stuff of legend rather than any kind of historical fact. But Kate also pointed out that the legends we have about our Chinese ancestors are just as important as the historical facts. But I would add, maybe they're even more important. The stories that we have are more important than the historical facts. And that we should consider the myths of early Zen or early Chan, not in the sense of being untrue or contrary to facts documented in the historical record, but in the sense of speaking what is universally true. True beyond any specific actual situation. Myth, in this sense, has been said to be that which never was, but always is. The Buddhist scholar John McRae, he wrote this: "None of the various details of Bodhidharma's life is true in the sense of being journalistically accurate. However, it is important to note that while the journalistic veracity of the story may be in doubt, the importance of the story to the development of Zen is beyond doubt." Bodhidharma. If you turn around behind you, you see on the altar two kind of dolls of Bodhidharma. One is bright red with one eye. The other carved of wood with a character carved into the belly part. It's a character for tenacity, patience, kind of. Because Bodhidharma is noted for the patience that he brought to the Zen practice. So whether or not Bodhidharma was an actual person, the legend of Bodhidharma plays a really key role in our Zen practice and in the Zen tradition. So if you recall from Wednesday, Bodhidharma is claimed to be the first Buddhist monk to bring the specific teachings of Zen from India to China. And much of his renown comes from the famous four-line teaching that has been attributed to him. A special transmission outside the scriptures, not depending on words and letters, pointing directly at the mind, seeing into one's true nature and attaining Buddhahood. At the weekend retreat, both Kate and I touched on this. So let's once again kind of acknowledge the importance of this little verse in the Zen tradition, but also acknowledge it speaks of degrees rather than absolutes. Certainly observing the mind, just as we've been doing for the past periods, is central to our Zen practice. But also scriptures, words, poems, letters, they also have their role in our practice. So who was this Bodhidharma character? Well, the myth of Bodhidharma really gives us very little about his growing up in India, or maybe it was Central Asia, other than to say he was a monk. And when he was very young, he was a prince. So a prince who became a monk, kind of echoing Shakyamuni Buddha, right? Sometime in the 4th or 5th century, he made the perilous journey from China, the perilous journey from India into China as a missionary. He came in order to teach and spread the Buddhist message. Now, this was a time when China was not the China we recognize of today. China at this point was divided up into at least three separate kingdoms. It was a time of great unrest and turmoil, when much of the population had starved or had died through disease, famine, and the wars that were constantly going on. So the legend does include all kinds of adventures that Bodhidharma experienced as he made his way from India into China. And in China, he met with the Emperor Wu of the Liang Dynasty, which was one of the three kingdoms in southeast China. Now this dynasty, the Liang Dynasty, only lasted about 50 years. It was quite a short one. And during that time, though, it had six emperors. So there was a lot of internecine fighting for the throne, brother killing brother, cousin killing cousin, in order to gain the throne, which was very common in almost all the Chinese dynasties. You wouldn't want to be born into the imperial family. So Emperor Wu, though, was a very strong supporter of Buddhism. Probably he saw it as a way to solidify his rule in the kingdom. And he built many temples and monasteries, and we know this for historical fact, sponsoring and supporting thousands of monks and nuns. And apparently he also studied Buddhism himself, becoming a kind of an amateur scholar. So naturally, when he heard of this monk arriving from India, the very birthland of Buddhism, he summoned this monk to his court to get the latest teachings. And their famous meeting is recorded in the Blue Cliff Record, which is quite a famous collection of 100 stories of the old Chinese Zen masters. And these stories come from a variety of sources. Some of them are from real events, some from imagined events and dialogues, but they were all compiled at least 500 years after this famous meeting of the Emperor Wu and Bodhidharma. So, I think now we should have our little skit about these guys. So, do you guys want to come forward? And we need one more person, actually, I just forgot, to be Master Chu. Short, two lines. Okay, so let me just pause for a second here. Well, thank you very much. So we'll come back to the dialogue in just a moment. But I'd like to just say a few more words about the legend. So after Bodhidharma left the emperor, apparently he wandered to Mount Songshan, which is in the northern China plain, and founded or came close to the temple known today as Shaolin Temple. So to get there, he crossed the Yangtze River on a reed using his supernatural power. So you'll see pictures of him sometimes, kind of like he's surfing, right? On this reed going across the river. And near the monastery, Bodhidharma sat in a cave in deep meditation, facing the wall for 9 years. And during that time, one legend has it, his legs withered away. He sat for so long. So if you see the Dharma dolls, for example, they have no legs. And this is the origin of the Dharuma doll. I think Kate also spoke about this at the retreat, but since there's a few new people here, I already pointed out those kind of egg-shaped ones on the altar. Often the bottom is weighted so that it's like, you know, those punching bags that you used to have as kids. You hit it and it comes, pops back up. another legend has it that in an effort to avoid falling asleep, Bodhidharma also cut off his eyelids and threw them out the cave door, where they immediately turned into China's first tea plants. So that's the origin of tea to help us keep awake as we meditate throughout the nights. And another Chinese story has it that Bodhidharma was appalled at the poor physical condition of some of the monks at the Shaolin Temple. And also, there were quite a few bandits around that would come at times and raid the temple. And so he taught the monks a series of external exercises, which became the foundation for Shaolin martial arts, so the monks could defend themselves. So clearly, he was a Renaissance man of many talents. And abilities. So the dialogue that we just heard, beautifully enacted, comes from, as I mentioned, the Blue Cliff Record, or in Japanese it's called the Hikiganroku. And it's the very first out of these series of 100 stories or cases. And I was thinking about this, perhaps it's the very first one, begins with Bodhidharma, because he really portrays the Zen attitude to teaching, and what we may call the kind of Zen character, the Zen approach to the Buddhist teachings. As we saw on Wednesday, with a little text I introduced, it was a little bit explanatory, but not really long explanations. If we look at the earlier sutras, particularly those ones that we see in the Theravada tradition, they're quite long explanations and often quite detailed, very logical, can be very helpful. But in Zen, the Zen texts that we see from this point onwards, they're very seldom do we see long explanations. And there's no engaging in really philosophical discussions either in these Zen texts, but rather simple, direct expressions, perhaps even abrupt descriptions pointing directly at the source. So in other words, and this fits, I think, with the kind of Chinese way of both artistic expression and in the literature, is you, which tends to be much more poetic, you want to express something in a way that doesn't really go through the intellect but goes directly into the heart. Now, the Chinese referred to Bodhidharma as the barbarian, but then Chinese referred to anyone who was not Chinese as a barbarian. And indeed, they probably were barbarians in the sense that they did not have the high culture of China. In Asia, China, from almost the beginning of what we may call a kind of society forming within the area today recognized as Asia, China has always been the center of culture. And it was Chinese culture that spread into Korea, Japan, Southeast Asia, etc. So in paintings of Bodhidharma, I meant to bring one and I forgot today, he's usually depicted, as Jonathan is here, with a shaggy reddish beard and an earring in one ear. You need an earring, Jonathan, yeah. And a rather scowling face, which if you look at the little Daruma dolls that I brought, you'll see that they're scowling always. So let's go back to the story, the dialogue there for a moment. Let me just get... Emperor Wu, or in our case, Empress Wu, had asked, how much karma merit have I earned doing all this good work? Ordaining monks, building monasteries, having sutras copied, Buddhist images made, all those kind of good merit things. And Bodhidharma tells the emperor, no merit. And I wonder how the emperor really understood this. You know, many religious traditions encourage acts of generosity, kindness, goodwill, but at the same time, also caution us against arrogance or clinging to a kind of desired result. And for example, in the Bhagavad Gita, one of the great holy texts of the Hindu tradition, Krishna, the divine being that's brought forward in the Bhagavad Gita, tells Arjuna, who is the main kind of human character, this. Krishna says, be intent on action, not on the fruits of action. Avoid attraction to the fruits, and also avoid attachment to inaction. Avoid attraction to the fruits. I was thinking about this, but this is really also the attitude of the Bodhisattva, the attitude of the vows that a Bodhisattva makes of beings are numberless, I vow to save them. right? Delusions are endless, I vow to end them, etc. The only way that we can possibly hold on to that vow is by letting go of our thoughts of success or accomplishment, to abandon all notions of accumulations or possession of merit of some kind. I was also thinking, given the climate march and things that have been going on, that this is the only way, really, that we can approach this kind of crisis that we face today. If we start to measure our success or failure, I think we'll be lost. We simply wholeheartedly make a vow, letting go of our focus on the fruits, on seeing our success, and just wholeheartedly devoting ourselves to our actions. And of course, this is true with our Zen practice, right? You practice to get enlightened, you'll be practicing for a long time. A long time. Am I there yet? Sometimes, you know, people get, and I include myself, you know, meditating for a week-long retreat, and something happens and you go, was that close? Am I getting there? And of course the answer is no. Not yet. So the emperor then, of course, says to Bodhidharma, well, what is the highest meaning of the holy truths? And Bodhidharma replies, empty, nothing holy. Now, we must admit, Bodhidharma certainly had chutzpah. Here and in the rest of the dialogue, we see a really severe, serious, and rather terse nature of the Zen teachings. Now, Zen teachings can also be humorous, and they can be quite playful, as we'll see in the coming weeks. But they are seldom expository. Empty, Bodhidharma says. Empty. Telling the emperor and telling us, all things are not as they seem to us. Now we all know everything is impermanent. Nothing lasts. But I think we fail to appreciate the magnitude of this. In our Zazen practice, our meditation practice, we come, hopefully, to sense that there is nothing but change, a flowing river of impermanence that holds all. This word empty, or the Sanskrit word shunyata, means having no essence, no permanent self of any kind. Rather than that, there is just boundlessness or limitlessness of all things. Kind of like the seasons streaming on and on, one flowing into the other, and yet each year different than the one that preceded it. Emptiness, or shunyata, is a word that points to the way things are. On one hand, this may seem kind of frightening, because there is no Michael. Even though I kind of think there's a Michael here. But emptiness is really our freedom. Because when we deeply appreciate emptiness, we can stop trying to hang on to something fixed, since there is nothing fixed to hang on to. and we can rest in the immense process of endless change. Dzogchen Norman Fisher, the founding teacher of Mountain Rain, calls this boundlessness love. Because ultimately there is no separation between you and me, between those sitting beside you, or the whole world. And I think in our Zazen we come to realize this more and more. As it says in the Heart Sutra that we just chanted a few minutes ago, given emptiness, there is no form, no sensation, no perception, no formation, no consciousness, no eyes, ears, nose, tongue, no body, no mind, no sight, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch. 10, 10, 10, 10, 10. In other words, there is nothing truly separate. Just designations that we use to help us as we wander through our daily life. Sometimes when I've been teaching about emptiness to my students at Simon Fraser University when I was teaching world religions, it would be like saying, looking at a piece of the body and saying, can you tell me exactly where the finger ends or begins? Where's that exact point where I can say, this is the finger, but this is not? Is there an exact point where the nose begins and ends? I mean, we need to talk about a nose, right? I have a runny nose, I have a big nose, my nose is too small, I need plastic surgery on my nose. We all know what the nose is in a relative way. The problem is we forget that there is no nose separate from everything else. That there's no clear marking, beginning of the nose or the end of a nose. There's just the flow, right? Flow through time. The nose you have now is not the same nose you had when you were 15 years old or 1 year old. It constantly changed just like you did. Every moment changing. Vast emptiness, or we could say boundlessness, vast boundlessness. So the other part of Bodhidharma's reply is nothing holy. Now this may seem a little bit strange coming from a monk, but it really does complete the answer. Indeed, if everything is boundless, if there is no clear distinction, no clear boundary we can draw where something is complete and separate and unto itself, if there is just the immense process of boundless change, how could there be any distinction between the sacred and the profane, between what is holy and what is not? Thich Nhat Hanh, the famous Vietnamese Zen teacher, talks about the rose becoming compost and the compost becoming the rose. But compost and rose are just designations to signify a moment of the flow itself. I think about this when I clean out the cat litter at home. Is the cat shit profane or sacred? Well, That's a koan, Ali, for you. So after receiving this reply from Bodhidharma, nonplussed and probably quite agitated, the emperor demanded, "Who is facing me?" Kind of like, "Who the hell do you think you are?" I said Bodhidharma had chutzpah, right? And Bodhidharma replied, "I don't know." Such an honest answer. How reflexive it is, isn't it? To simply answer, "I'm Michael," or "I'm a teacher," or "I'm a nurse," or "I'm an artist," "I'm an idiot." When we sit in meditation, though, who we are is not so clear. In fact, it's not really clear at all. Given shunyata or emptiness, who am I? Given all the experiences in your life, all the influences that have touched you, all the thoughts that have arisen and disappeared, the emotions that have raged through you and dissipated, and given the genetics that you received from your mother and father, and the changes that have happened constantly in your body, who are you? Who am I? Your life story, whether you're 20 years old or as ancient as I am, written in detail would fill books. But is that history you? This not knowing of the Buddha, of Bodhidharma, is not ignorance, and it's also not humility. It's an offering of the vast quality of the human condition, and maybe demonstrating the impossibility of trying to put you, your totality of everything that is you, which of course goes beyond, into words. There is a great power in not knowing that is lost in an answer. So as much as the Emperor of China, Emperor Wu, wanted an answer, perhaps Bodhidharma's greatest gift was just to turn and leave, allowing the emperor to dwell in the power of the question itself. This is the essence of how we work with koans, the essence of how we work with the profound questions that life gives us at various times. Koans are just moments described in the various collections. We might say they're like tools we can pick up, but life gives us tools all the time anyway. Gives us these questions that we cannot answer in a kind of logical, rational way and feel like we've done it. Profound questions of life and death, of sickness, of old age, of birth. And these questions teach us the true vastness of who we are. And so I thought I'd like us to do a little kind of funny exercise today about this. Kind of taste the koan, so to speak, because this dialogue is taken up as a koan in various ways in the Zen tradition. And I'm going to ask you to get together with a partner in just a moment. And you're going to ask each other the same questions that the emperor asked Bodhidharma, and you're going to give the same answers. But I'd like you to do it slowly and just sense, feel if there's any veracity there for you, any truth. So I have copied them out, so hopefully this will help. So you're going to ask, one person will ask, what is the highest meaning of the holy truths? Empty without holiness. Who is facing me? I don't know. And then switch. And then switch back. And then switch again. I'd like you to do this 4 times with your partner. Does that make sense? And then we'll just kind of debrief it a little bit at the end.